Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and we are diving beneath the headlines today on the biggest story of the week here in Greater Boston, and that is undoubtedly the white supremacist march that shattered the 4th of July weekend in Boston. Up to 100 masked marchers from a known white supremacist group descended on the city, apparently to the surprise of police and city officials. Activist Charles Morrell, who was black, says marchers attacked them near Copley Square. Boston Herald photographer Stuart Cahill captured the moment. Now, in the week since, Morrell has demurred from sharing that experience, speaking about it publicly only sparingly at press conferences. Morrell was set to join us today, but just a few minutes ago decided to hold off. We hope to connect with them on Monday. But we do have analysts with us to help make sense of what happened last weekend and everything we've learned in the ensuing days. Former Boston City Councilor Tito Jackson is here in Studio 2. Thanks for joining us, Tito.
Thank you for having me.
And Joan Donovan, Research Director at Harvard's Shorenstein Center on Media, Politics, and Public Policy, is with us on the line. Thanks for joining us, Joan.
Great to be here.
Okay, Tito, I'm going to start with you for a minute, and I am going to take us back to last Saturday.
They rip children from wombs and sow a ground beneath your feet to foreigners. And then they tell you it is justice.
Nazis out of Boston! 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 Nazis out of Boston!
Tito, how'd you find out? Where were you and what went through your mind? And what goes through your mind in hearing that sound?
So I was in the city of brotherly love and sisterly affection down in Philadelphia. And I began to get text messages and a couple of phone calls and obviously switched on to the Globe and the Herald. And for me, this is... One, a show of where we are at as a country, as a people, and as a union. And it's a real decision point that individuals on the 4th of July, the day in which most attribute to freedom as a black American, obviously Juneteenth is that day for me. This is something that is... something that we have to, as a people, address. And as a black person, you also don't get to address this in a vacuum. So Jaylen Walker was also shot 60 times this weekend.
In Akron, Ohio. Black man.
Yep.
Police stop.
Right. And this is this. And Robert Crimmo, just recently shot.
Highland Park shoot.
And so the component in question here is parity. I don't believe that
P-A-R-O-D-Y or P-A-R-I-T-Y.
That's a really good question. I guess I would simply say to you, are we treating people the same? And if and I think Mr. Morrell brings up a really important point. As a black man, if 100 of us were marching down the street and assaulted someone, would there be a delay in stopping the whole group, arresting the whole group, and figuring out what happened? And so, these are issues that are now being thought of and addressed with the Boston Police Department. I would say the encouraging piece for me, though, is that U.S. Attorney Rachel Rollins and Mayor Michelle Wu, FBI Special Agent John Bonavolanta and ADL and ACLU, all in the room with community members addressing this issue. And I don't know that that room existed 11 years ago when I first got on the city council. But this is a reckoning in the city of Boston. And it'll be interesting to see if those individuals ever come back. And if they come to Ruggles Station, if they come to Jackson Square,
versus Oak Grove out in,
exactly, or Dudley Square. So they understand the demographics, and they understand the play in which they're involved in.
Okay, so I'm going to turn to Joan Donovan in a second, but to pick up on a thread, we have some sound from U.S. Attorney for Massachusetts Rachel Rollins appearing on Greater Boston Wednesday night, echoing this theme about parity, P-A-R-I-T-Y.
There is a real tension between certain communities, and this is what we talked about today, the mayor and myself and other law enforcement partners, where there are certain communities that feel like they are surveilled and watched constantly, and then other communities, you know, even though these individuals might not be from here per se, but that have the freedom to show up and march without any sort of questioning or altercation.
So I want to make it clear to listeners, the reason, Joan, that we brought you and we brought Tito together is there's kind of at least two dimensions that we're trying to dig into here. One is what happened in the city, the context of race, the city's response, et cetera. The second is a hate group that came to the city, what we know about hate groups, how they organized, whether they should have been known to us in this plan, et cetera. Tito helps us a lot with the first. Joan, this is your research on the second, but I'm just going to start by asking you to react to everything you just heard, anywhere you want to go.
Yeah, I think, you know, when we think about what these groups are trying to prove when they show up to a city like Boston, which is incredibly multiracial, and like Philadelphia, perhaps known for a bit of our warm confrontation. What they're trying to do is create content. They're trying to create situations in which they can create viral videos. The uniform look of the participants that is coordinated so that they look strong and disciplined together. And we've seen Patriot Front do this in a number of different cities where they show up in a U-Haul and all jump out together and march with the drums. And so this to me feels a lot like 2016 when we saw the rise of the alt-right. And of course, Patriot Front was part of that rise of the alt-right. And there had been a fissure within that movement about what it meant to do physical protests and to be present in public space. And Patriot Front has decided that these flash mob gatherings are going to be the most advantageous to them for spreading their message through violence and then, you know, having a prominent website online where people can go and learn more. And so, unfortunately, this is something that we're going to see repeated many times in many different cities until police figure out a way to confront them and stop them from doing it.
So there's a lot there. I think the first thing I will pick up on, I'm going to play a little more sound here from U.S. Attorney for Massachusetts Rachel Rollins on Greater Boston Wednesday about, you said, you know, there's a prominent website where people can go and learn more. Let me just play some Rollins sound.
This organization itself, Patriot Front, NSC 131, yeah, they are actively working to be covert so that they will not be infiltrated. They will not be stopped by law enforcement. We saw in Idaho, though, that there were arrests that were made, and some of those individuals are here in Boston as well.
So first, Patriot Front and NSC 131 are different organizations, both prominent as far as white supremacist organizations in Boston and Massachusetts go. That sounds different than what you said, Joan.
Yeah, no, what they're talking about isn't necessarily the message that these groups want to put out in public, but rather their organizing style, which with Patriot Front has gotten more and more clandestine over the years. They used to use gamer chat apps like Discord to get organized. That had been infiltrated by a set of activists, several of which were from Boston, who would publish their communications. So these groups have now started to go further and further into encrypted messaging apps to plan these events. And what we know from some of the video when they were leaving Oak Grove is some of the license plates were from different states, including Texas. So it's not the case that many of those people live here, although undoubtedly some of them do, because we did have the organization right at the beginning or earlier than the pandemic of those straight pride marches. And those did reveal that there were some of these white nationalist folks organizing here in Boston. One more famously has been arrested in the January 6th insurrection, who's from Malden, which is very close to where Oak Grove is.
I think actually a couple, right, from Super Happy Fun America.
Exactly. And so these groups are often intertwined, and the naming of them is really, performative in many senses. They're all here for a very similar outcome, which is they want to put white identity on the map and they want to put white nationalism on the political agenda.
And that to me is one of the things that really strikes at the consciousness and from a safety perspective, things that mm-hmm. folks in the Black community really are thinking about and on folks' hearts. So we have many places of worship. I go to Union United Methodist Church. Shout out to my pastor, Pastor Jay. We are the one church that I know of, the one Black church that I know of that has performed gay marriages. And so, thinking about the safety, which is actually our church is not too far from there. Reverend Willie Broderick, who you often feature, who's an amazing leader in the city of Boston at 12th Baptist. What is the state of play for safety? And we have seen Black churches attacked. And so that is one of the things that, some of this sounds to be performative, right? But when it comes down to the actual safety of Black and brown folks, people from the AAPI community, the trans community, and diverse communities in the city of Boston, that is another component that we all need to think of. And I do again, feel that there was leadership shown by Attorney General, U.S. Attorney Rachel Rollins, as well as Mayor Michelle Wu, by pulling people together into the same space and place to address these issues. So that's a really important thing. And as noted, this piece around how police can deal with this. Well, there was an assault. We know or alleged, let's even say alleged assault. So that gives the police an opportunity to do something that they oftentimes wouldn't do based on issues around First Amendment. So we need to kind of think about how these individuals who are holding shields, by the way, who knew not to bring those shields on the train, which they didn't, so someone actually took them from them, and also these individuals who parked outside of the view of cameras, when they went to Oak Grove. So there's a lot of coordination that is connected here. I also just think it's an opportunity for us to come together as a city. And this can't only be Black and brown folks and people from diverse communities. This is an opportunity for white allies who many people called call 311, 911, and the like in neighborhoods that are not predominantly people of color where they march through. So that's a start. And I think we can come together as a city and lead and not follow on these issues.
We're talking to former Boston City Councilor Tito Jackson and Harvard researcher Joan Donovan as we dive beneath the headlines of the white supremacist march last weekend in the city of Boston, but that certainly shook the region. Joan, Tito just talked a lot about safety issues, what we can do to protect people, what we need to do, who is vulnerable. I want to pick up a couple of things on that, and I'm going to start by playing a little bit of sound from a press conference on Tuesday. This is FBI Special Agent in Charge Joseph Bonavolanta.
Hate speech can be at times covered by the First Amendment if it rises to a level where there is a threat or use of force or violence. That is where we can and have gotten involved and initiated investigations.
So I'm going to parse that out a little bit. We had current Boston City Councilor Ricardo Arroyo on the show Wednesday, picking up on Tito's point and saying when there was an alleged assault, that changed what the police could have done in the moment, which is detain people to question them about a possible crime that it had been alleged happened. But we also have heard this week as events have unfolded and people have talked about it, tensions around whether or not to surveil a group like this in advance because there are freedom of speech issues, et cetera, and that you've got to wait till after a crime has happened for somebody like the FBI to follow. I know you've probably followed all those threads, Joan. So the question is, what do you agree and disagree with? And what must cities and towns be doing, recognizing this is coming and there are vulnerable populations who are physically at risk as a result?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we have to definitely think about, and I appreciate Tito's intervention here, because it's Black communities tend to be the targets of this, these kind of hate groups where they, you know, will go and leave messages or the stickers. And it's definitely a more subtle form of intimidation. And then what we see is these groups, you know, really want to show and get media coverage for their actions. And so we have to wonder about when they're doing this and why. Of course, Patriot Front attacking LGBTQ parades and whatnot is also something that we've seen last month during Pride Month. So it's really important that we understand that vulnerable groups that are put under such stress, and we have to think about what happened in Buffalo as well, here in the context of Black Americans thinking about, well, if I'm just doing normal everyday activities and I'm at risk for this kind of vigilante violence, who is going to protect us?
Doesn't that mean it's working, Joan?
It does. I mean, psychologically, yes, it does create a culture of fear, a culture of looking over one's shoulder. But in the communities that I circulate in, it also creates a form of solidarity where we depend less and less on the state for protection and more on each other. And it's what's been interesting over the years in terms of infiltration of Patriot Front groups is that there have been activists, anti-fascist activists for years that have been tracking their movements. The reason why some of these more recent events have caught people off guard is because Patriot Front is getting better at organizational security. That is to say that they're becoming more disciplined. And that's where I think it's going to be really important for police to start to step in. And this is very this is national. You know, you have these groups traveling between states in order to do this. Some of it is free speech, but when violence happens, which in many respects is intended as part of the show of force, they crave that kind of confrontation. You know, that's a reason why the state should begin thinking about, well, how am I going to keep track of what we might end up now having to develop policies around, which is domestic terrorism. One thing I want to bring attention to, because the Patriot Front website does record all of their actions and show what cities they've been in. And they have a list of all their activities. And in Massachusetts is the second most active state. So Patriot Front is very active in Texas, second in Massachusetts, third in Virginia, fourth in Connecticut, and fifth in Pennsylvania. So you can see that this is something that where the membership is dense, like in Texas and Massachusetts, those are the kinds of communities that we're going to have to look out for and protect and double down on understanding these groups' intentions and actions.
So Tito Jackson, hearing researcher Joan Donovan there talk about that, a couple of things come into my mind at once. One of the reasons we specifically wanted to talk to you is that you were active in the protests after the murder of George Floyd in the summer of 2020. And somewhat locally, famously, in front of the Boston Police Department station during a tense time between marchers and police officers. Joan said a moment ago, you know, police need to intervene. We've had some argument from local activists this week that the police don't want to intervene. Now, I want to say that the law enforcement has said that their concern was looking like they were escorting a white supremacist group if there was an accompaniment, that there was concern about optics. Pick those threads for us for a minute.
Yeah. So, you know, it's one thing to do good, but you also must be seen doing good. And in this regard, I think they're could have been another action here. And I would submit to you as a middle-aged black man, when I was a young person, I've been in groups, and actually sometimes not actually in the group, and I've been stopped.
You mean just in proximity?
In proximity. And I didn't do anything. And so in this case, there was an opportunity here. And so we need to kind of think through that. And mind you, I also understand this kind of perception component around the Boston Police Department not wanting to look like, hey, we're going to escort these guys down Boylston Street. And I think that would also be problematic. But I think it is very important that, one, people are in the room, connected, having these conversations with one another, which I do think is happening. But I think we have to put in context, you and I had a conversation prior to the show, ironically, Common Ground Revisited, which is a play about a book by J. Anthony Lucas.
About busing in the 1970s.
The play was ending the same day. And so that's and there's a backdrop, and I don't have time to discuss what Common Ground is, but people who are from this area definitely know.
Well, we covered it. We'll put a link to the story that we covered that explains all this on our website at radioboston.org with this feature.
And there's a backdrop, and there's some teasing in that play about where do we want our future to go, and really, are we in the same place? And I would
say we were in 1974.
That is a question right now. Are we in the same place? But the most important question is, where are we headed and how do we get there? And I think the way that we do that is together. This is where a word that I didn't have when I was a young person called intersectionality, where people who are not necessarily the folks who are in the line of fire are able to come connect with and have each other's back when it comes to what is going on in our city. And so it is really critical that communities as a whole, and not only communities of color, not only our LGBTQIA communities, AAPI communities, that we come forward as a show of force and say who we are as a city of Boston. And we are a city that is, I believe, about turning to each other, not on each other in these difficult times, as my former boss used to say. So we have an opportunity right now in this moment. And this is the question is, what would you have been doing in the civil rights movement? What would you have been doing in Nazi Germany? Where would you stand? And you know what? Thinking about what that used to be, you have an opportunity to stand in the right place today, to do the right things today, to speak out, and to stand up for what is right in this time, because that is literally what we are facing in the city of Boston and the United States of America in 2022.
And Harvard researcher Joan Donovan, back to you just briefly, kind of for a last word on this. Tito Jackson just laid out a bit of a blueprint for what must happen in communities in response to the moment that we're in. I mean, I have 52 more questions. If we could go 3 more hours, there's so much more. But in this short moment, what I do want to ask you is, based on what you've learned, what do cities and towns have to do when white supremacy bursts to the surface in this type of organized way in order to keep it from continuing to happen?
I mean, it is as sad as it sounds, we have to stay vigilant. We have to look for some of the earlier warning signs. Sometimes that involves making sure that we know what's happening online and what these groups are planning. That would be something that the role of the state could play. But more often than not, it's citizens that are going to notice these changes in their cities and areas if they start noticing stickers and other kinds of paraphernalia, things that mention Western civilization or taking the country back. Those are signs that there are white nationalists in your area and in your neighborhood. And we've started to see flyers being placed on people's cars and on people's driveways. So we are in the midst of this group of people waking up, becoming more organized, wanting to become more public. And I have no doubt it has to do with elections coming up, as well as the desire to cause this kind of violence and create this fear in communities. And so it's going to be important that churches and other people build those networks and question what it means to find these stickers. They can always, if they see things up in their neighborhood and they don't understand them, they can always take a picture of them and send it to me on Twitter. I'm happy to see if it has anything to do with any of these movements. But yeah, that's the community is the solution here.
And quickly, your Twitter handle, Joan?
Boston Joan.
All right.
So I accept, you know, these kind of images and also really cute cats and dogs. So big animal fan.
And we will not be moved by cowards mm-hmm. in khakis. That's not
no.
happening.
Oh goodness!
In our time, these are cowards, and these are individuals mm-hmm. who didn't want to wear a mask during COVID, but have no problem wearing a mask right now. We're going to stand up as a city and as a people, and show that the city of Boston is not going to have this.
All right, Tito Jackson is former Boston City Councilor and CEO and founder of Apex Noir Cannabis, and Joan Donovan is research director at Harvard's Shorenstein Center on Media, Politics, and Public Policy, and an expert on extremist organizations. You both are always good to the show. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Let's take a road trip, shall we? Pack the snacks. We're going to Provincetown.
In the very center of town is the Pilgrim Monument, the 250-foot granite tower that you can see from almost anywhere, like a pin on a map, marking where you'll find me and all the other gays this summer.
That is Mitra Kaboli, and you just heard a bit of episode one of her new podcast, Welcome to Provincetown. Mitra and her co-producer, Emily Foreman, followed some P-Town summer and full-time residents as they navigate the highs and lows of living in this seaside community. From a Black trans street busker named Star to an older, long-term resident named Jay, the series explores the reality of life in Provincetown in the present and also in the past in a sound-rich, deep way. Mitra Kaboli, host and co-creator of Welcome to Provincetown, joins us now on the line. Mitra, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us is Ben Riskin, who is co-founder of Room Tone, which helped create the podcast. He's been a P-Town summer resident for over a decade. Ben, joining us. Thanks.
Thank you so much for having me.
So Mitra, I know, and we'll get into this more in a little bit, you were excited and curious to go live in P-Town for the summer of 2021. What makes it special to you?
Well, Provincetown is a really, really interesting place. You know, it's full of like performers and writers and just like all kinds of people. And it's this idyllic kind of two-street beach town. In the winter, it's so quiet, sleepy, you know, only like 3,000 people live there. And in the summer, the population just explodes to something around 60,000. And I was just really curious about what that meant for a place. And, you know, given that it's kind of this like really iconic queer haven, I was just, you know, really interested to find out what that place had to offer, you know, visitors, the people who live there, and myself, you know.
So, Ben, you've lived in Provincetown in the summers for a number of years now. And I'm curious, like from the very beginning, the first summer you got there, were you thinking, oh, we gotta do something on this? Or was it only recently that you thought, oh, there should be a podcast?
Yeah, I've been coming up for, this is my 15th summer. And 15th. I think for me, I've always just been so enamored by the people I meet here, by the friends I have here. And, you know, the whole town feels like a stage. And so when I came up here, initially, I actually wasn't working in audio. Several years later, you know, as Jay says, in one episode, I came out as an artist, let's say, and started working in audio. And it felt like something immediately that I wanted to work on was finding a way to reflect on the lives of the people that live here and the people that work here.
And Mitra, the people that live and work in Provincetown, the people both, you know, long-term residents and summer people that you focus on, they are full, complete characters. I'm going to play a little sound for our listeners. I want them to start to get to know people in the podcast here. So this is, I'm going to play a little of Kaya Kristal. Now, Kaya is a drag queen singer, performer, who's been performing in Provincetown for the last few years, but picked up major steam in the summer of 2021. And here Kaya is talking about their grandmother.
I modeled myself after my great-grandmother, my grandmother, and my mother, all three very strong, very independent, unapologetic Black women who know how to dress. Like, Sundays were head-to-toe a complete look, and nails were on, and lashes were on, and hats were done, and, you know, the shoe was a sensible church shoe, but, like, that is the goal. So that when I'm walking down the street, people aren't like, oh, look at that drag queen. They're like, oh my God, look at this beautiful goddess of a being that is gracing us with her presence.
And just to note, when you first see pictures of Kaya, you are like, oh my God, here is this goddess. So was it a case where you had to go looking for characters for this podcast, or were they everywhere, Mitra?
It's a little bit of both. You know, before I got to Provincetown, I had heard about Kaya, and I kind of had a feeling that I wanted to, you know, spend some time with her and get to know her if she was interested in having me follow her around. Everyone had kind of said she's like the it girl of the summer. I was like, what does that mean? And I was curious to find out. And Ben introduced me to some other people. You know, we meet Sunny, who's kind of, you know, just in P-Town for the summer and trying to have kind of a carefree time. And then, of course, we have Kristen, Ethan, and Stacey Starr, who are part of Summer of SAS, which is a queer youth work program. And so Ethan and Stacey were there for the summer to live and work for the summer, you know. And I was really, I was interested in, you know, what that meant for, you know, young people to come to Provincetown who had maybe never heard of it.
Okay, so I you picked up on Sunny, and we've got some great sound here from Sunny. And this is a piece where you're beginning to tell us Sunny's story. So we're going to hear both Sunny and a little bit of you, Mitra.
We just came off a really tough year. I had not the great, like, I know I'm not unique in this, but it was a really tough year for my career. Like, I have to pivot after a 13-year career with an organization that I love and now figure out something else that I want to do.
He got laid off from his job at the YMCA, where he'd been working since he was 16.
It was just a very out of the blue way to find out that I don't have a plan anymore for my life. To have that kind of just like snatched away out of the blue was just, I don't know. It was really hard.
So Ben, Mitra said Sunny was there to have a light, carefree summer. People come to Provincetown for all kinds of reasons, and that is so thoroughly captured by the various characters. Stacey, who Mitra mentioned, Ethan, who Mitra mentioned. Talk about that a little bit.
I think that Provincetown has always been this safe haven, this place that feels, you know, it's 50 miles into the Atlantic Ocean. It's the very end of Route 6. The road literally peters out into sand. And it's this place that feels totally safe. It feels where it's a place where you feel represented, or rather that I feel represented and that many other people do. And consequently, a lot of LGBTQ folks come here to heal, to change something in their life, to get away and just have a carefree time. And consequently, you get all of these very interesting people here going through various different stages of their lives. Later in the season, you'll meet Brian, who is an assistant harbor master and going through a divorce. We'll learn a little bit about how Provincetown took care of its own during the AIDS epidemic. And it's the whole goal of the show was to reflect that real wild diversity of people here. It's not just diversity in the sense that there are LGBTQ folks, but that there are individuals going through a variety of different things in their lives and finding solace in this beautiful and isolated place that lets them get through it.
So, Mitra, I'm so glad Ben said that, because one of the things we really wanted to ask you about, your journey becomes part of this podcast. And it's a little weird to play sound of someone to someone, but the language you use here is so important. So we're going to play a little bit of your own musings from the podcast.
I, too, feel like I'm in a state of transition. A few years ago, I made the decision to leave the safety of the straight side of my bisexuality behind and fling myself fully into the unknowns of a queer life. But I hardly know what that means or what my life could look like. This summer, I was hoping to unlock the secrets of growing old and gay, unrestricted by the norms of a straight life.
Did you unlock those secrets, Mitra? Did you accomplish what you wanted to for you while you told these stories?
Well, I mean, that's a good question that I fully don't have the answer to yet, but you will have to listen to find out. I mean, I did, you know, I had kind of like a big gay summer in a way that I'd never really had before. And it was just so enjoyable. You know, I really enjoyed my time in Provincetown. And more than maybe, you know, my like quintessential like gay experience that I had there, it was just such a nice place to spend time. You know, I normally live in New York City, and it was just, you know, like it was, life in New York can be a struggle. And just being in Provincetown, I was like, like I could exhale a little bit. And just, even though I was working all the time, it was just so easy. You know, it's, everything is 5 minutes away. You know, you could just jump into the ocean for 10 minutes. And there was something about that that did change me in a way. I was, you know, now I'm thinking about what it is that I actually want in my life and what I value in, you know, my relationship to my sexuality and just what I want out of my life.
So I want to note, you said we'll have to listen to find out. The first five episodes are published, so and we'll have links on our website at radioboston.org for folks. And just to remind everyone, we're speaking with Mitra Kaboli, who is host a podcast and host of the podcast and co-creator and co-producer of the podcast Welcome to Provincetown, along with Ben Riskin, who's a summer resident there and co-creator of the podcast. Ben, in your last answer to me, you brought up the history of AIDS and the way it's impacted the Provincetown community. And I'm going to hit two things here with that. This podcast also talks to long-time residents, right, who have built a life and the experience long-term of the LGBTQ community in Provincetown. And I'm going to play a little bit of Jay Critchley, who is one of the characters, the long-term characters, talking about AIDS. And for the studio, this is pro-E. Let's play a little bit here.
Yeah, 1983 was the year that the Boston radio and TV stations were talking about what was going on in Provincetown with this gay disease. And they were showing images of empty beaches and like scaring, people were getting scared about coming here. I was working at a whale watching business part-time at the time, and I remember getting a couple of calls, people saying, are any of the staff members gay?
So, Ben Riskin, the history of AIDS and Provincetown itself are actually both characters in this podcast, at least for me as a listener. And was that built on purpose, or did it emerge that this was the fact as you guys sought to tell these stories?
I think it's a fact of living here that everywhere you go is the oldest something, or this used to be owned by this person who now does this, and can you believe they also said this to this person? It's a small town, and it has that kind of mix of history and lore, which I think is what makes a certain kind of magic about it. But when it comes to AIDS, and when it comes to community care within among the LGBTQ community, I think that's a character in all of our lives, whether we're in Provincetown, New York, or, you know, Wichita. It's something that decimated our community. It's something that has, you know, been reflected in a variety of different medium where, you know, we see how this community came together and organized and took care of its own when the government decided not to. And consequently, it's part of all of our lives, including the younger generation that didn't live through it, including myself and the older generation of people who maybe lived directly through it or caught the tail end of it, or of the worst part of it. It's certainly still happening today, and perhaps to different parts of our community.
So Mitra, earlier this week, we had a conversation about the Delta outbreak in Provincetown last summer. And one of the things that we reflected on was the way the community, because of its history of experience with HIV/AIDS, responded very quickly, understood how to prevent the spread of a pandemic, really were quick in communicating, supporting research, et cetera. And I juxtapose that to a theme that I hear from you a lot in the podcast about different worlds and sort of a lack of solidarity and shared experience in Provincetown. So as we go out here, I just want to hear you reflect a little bit on that.
Yeah, I mean, while I was there during the Delta outbreak, it was so interesting. You know, all of a sudden I'm getting fielding all these texts and calls from people I maybe hadn't heard from in a while being like, I heard you're in Provincetown. I hope you're okay. And, you know, I was like kind of on the ground, you know, I could see that, you know, the town was responding, even like tourists and visitors. I believe that it was like a group of tourists who kind of like organized themselves. They like realized that they got COVID and kind of made this like spreadsheet and contact traced among each other and then shared that with like federal and state health agencies and really controlled the outbreak really quickly. You know, in a matter of weeks, it had kind of really kind of petered out pretty quickly. And, you know, that was pretty, it was really amazing, you know, and the town kind of needed, they couldn't really have another summer financially like the one they had in 2020. You know, businesses were really suffering because it is seasonal and so much is riding on the summer economy there. And while I was there, though, I was just like, wow, people are really like getting this done. Everyone's wearing masks. We're all kind of together in this. And, you know, it kind of felt like there's no better place to be right now. There's tons to do outside. So I felt pretty well taken care of.
All right. That is Mitra Kaboli, who is host and co-creator of Welcome to Provincetown, along with Ben Riskin, co-founder of Roomtone, which helped create the podcast. He's also been a P-Town summer resident for over a decade. Episodes 1 through 5 are out now. Again, you can find more information on our website, radioboston.org. Thanks so much to both of you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
All right, and we're going to go out for you here before the next segment on a little more from Kaya Kristal singing Alicia Keys in Provincetown last winter.
Ladies and gentlemen, The Weeknd.
I got to admit, I just never get tired of hearing that. It is hot, it's humid, it's beach weather, and all the possibilities of summer are right here, right now. So let's find some ways to enjoy the weekend around the Commonwealth. Back here in Studio 2 to share some ideas, WBUR's senior arts and culture reporter, Cristela Guerra. Welcome back, Cristela.
Happy to be here.
I know you've got a busy weekend planned.
I do.
Yeah, you always do, though. I mean, you have the best weekend life of anyone I know.
I mean, I appreciate that. Fair.
All right, so first things first, we've got the revival from a Boston music venue that sadly, really sadly, closed during the pandemic, but they're back with a pop-up show. So this is the Great Scott pop-up.
So Great Scott is beloved. It was, I think, one of those places that people were just really mourning. So they're very excited. This is going to be an event at the Bell Forge Art Center in Medfield. It's Saturday from noon to that evening. Free to all, but be cautious, parents, because the music can be explicit. So just, you know, with little ones, just be cautious. And artists are like Gym Shorts, The Benjis, and Comedy from the Gas.
All right, so we did pull a little music, and I think Sydney was careful to pull stuff that was not explicit. So this is Rhode Island-based Gym Shorts with their song, I'm the Jeff Gordon of Our Generation. So that's what you can hear in Medfield this weekend, but you've got more music for us in New Bedford.
Yes. So the New Bedford Folk Festival, back for its first year after the pandemic. It's all weekend, July 9th and 10th at around New Bedford, various locations. We've got, I think, $40 for a day pass, $50 for the whole weekend. And we've got some music for you. This is a guy named Tom Rush, known in the folk scene. He came up in Cambridge in the 1940s, and he's doing a cover that you can hear now of Sleepy John Estey's Drop Down Mama.
Drop down mama, let you. Daddy, see, you got some of that, baby, keeps on worrying me. My mama don't lie to me.
lot of different artists there that weekend. I know, though, you want to also take us to the Arboretum. Oh, no. You've got more music.
I have more music for you. Yes. You do it. Someone who I actually really like. It's very soothing. This is a newer voice on the folk scene. It's another piece of tape by Elisa Amador, who won the 2022 NPR Tiny Desk Contest for this song, Milonga Accidental.
Cuando miro afuera, cuando miro adentro, cuando miro afuera otra vez.
Okay, and I'm actually going to editorialize for a minute here because I've had a chance to hear her perform this in person.
Really?
And that song, that's beautiful, but it does not do justice to the serenity of being live and hearing her play that cuatro.
Oh, gosh, I have to now.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so now you're going to take us to the Arboretum, too, though, a little closer home here in Jamaica Plain. And this is the Mask Ball, spelled M-A-S-S-Q.
Yep. So basically, you're going to find families, you're going to find kids. This is called an intergenerational cross-cultural exhibition. And I think the point, the heart of it, the question is, if we together could author our own creation story, what would we create? So imagine performances, artwork from local artists. I think people can commune with the artists and kind of talk through the kind of experience they want to have. And a lot of body painting.
So, okay, so wait. A, body painting.
Yes.
What? And B, so you're saying that people can be with the artists and sort of, and they'll build art together and create an artistic experience together.
They're calling them ceremonial vessels. And they'll learn about African folklore, poetry by Zija, who I adore, indigenous dance, hip-hop performances. It's going to be a day.
Okay, and again, this is in JP, right?
In JP, tomorrow from 2 to 7.
Okay, last but not least, now there's an exhibit at the Boston Children's Museum that you actually reported on for WB. I can see the happy smile on your face, so tell us about this.
I did. Oh, my gosh. It's so beautiful, Tiziana. It's a small gallery, Boston Children's Museum. It's there through the end of the month. July 24th is the last day you could catch it. And imagine, like, you know, you're in a castle and you see the royals, and there are portraits of them. So in this case, it's a bunch of trans kids between the ages of 6 and 12. And this non-binary artist named Noah Grigney took it upon themselves to spend the pandemic getting to know them over Zoom and painting them in acrylics, getting to know their families, just really capturing them as they wanted. If that means wolves in the sky, they're wolves in the sky. If that means in pastels with colors like a field of wildflowers, that's what you've got. And they're gorgeous, and they're very sweet. It's a very tender exhibit, and I just can't say enough how much people have to go see it.
All right. So how many cities and towns will you be in this weekend trying to cover and see all of this?
Well, my mom's in town, so I got to show her a lot of things. Yeah, you know, I mean, I think we're going to try and go salsa dancing. I think I want to go to JP. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, being that it's her last night, I mean— I don't know, maybe the Greek festival in Raleigh? We'll
see.
Nice.
All right, that is Cristela Guerra, Senior Arts and Culture Reporter for WBUR, and our guide, as usual, to the boundless possibilities this weekend. I love having you here, Cristela. Thank you.
I love being here.
And we're going to go out today with more from Elisa Amador. This is the track Milonga Accidental. And me was, that's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Tiziana Deering. Have a great weekend. Join us again Monday for more Radio Boston.